Mercury is one of the terrestrial planets here in the solar system, and yet it is one of the least explored. And that is because it is one of the hardest places to get in the solar system. It requires as much propellant to get to Mercury as it does to get to Pluto. And so figuring out ways to get down deep into the solar system, to be able to reach Mercury, have been a big challenge. But there is a technology that is perfect for getting closer and closer to the sun, and that is, surprisingly, solar sails. That the strongest wind is blowing close to the sun, and that's where Mercury is, and that's why you want to take a solar sail. So my guest today is Dr. Stephen Parman. He is a professor at Brown University in the Department of Earth, Environmental and Planetary Science, and he has proposed the Mercury Scout mission. This is a mission that would use a gigantic solar sail to carry a new set of instruments to Mercury. And it would be able to do this purely under solar light pressure alone. And then once it reached Mercury, it would be able to go into orbit, change its orbit, maneuver however it wants, maybe even bring a sample return mission back from Mercury and deliver it to Earth. It's a really exciting idea. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation with Dr. Stephen Parman. Stephen, you proposed a really interesting idea for a solar sail mission, and I'm all about solar sails, and I really want to talk about that. But before we get started, I want you to just make the case for why Mercury is such an interesting planet for us to explore.
Absolutely. Obviously, it's the closest planet to our sun, and a lot of exoplanets are found very close to their host stars. And so if we want to understand formation of planets very close to a star, Mercury is our best bet in our solar system. Forming so close to the sun has set it on a very, very different compositional evolutionary trajectory than the other planets. It's in particular, it's oxygen fugacity. It's basically an oxygen starved planet. And so it has evolved very different compositions of magmas, its internal structure, everything is different. And we think many exoplanets would be similar to that. So if we just want to understand also their kind of internal evolution, whether they'd be good hosts for life, Mercury is the place to go.
That's interesting. You mentioned this idea of oxygen starved. But, you know, I think about the moon and its silicon oxide, its titanium oxide, its aluminum oxide, that if we tried to mine the metals off of the moon, oxygen would be a waste gas that we'd have to just vent off into space and start creating an atmosphere on the moon. And it's not like that. Like, what are these metals and stuff on the surface of Mercury like?
Yeah, so it's oxygen, sorry, it's not oxygen free. And so if we think of the Earth and the Moon, there's metallic iron cores, but there's also FeO in the mantle and the crust. And so the Earth and the Moon, Mars, Venus, they sit kind of on this edge where iron, some of it's bonded with oxygen, some of it's bonded with iron, is just iron metal, not bonded with any oxygen. Mercury is this experiment where you start, natural experiment, where you start removing oxygen to the point where there's no oxygen for the iron. So there's essentially no FeO on Mercury. All the iron is metallic iron. And even you go further and you say, well, there's not enough oxygen for magnesium and calcium. And do they form metal? No, what we see is they bond with sulfur. And so you get these crazy sulfides, magnesium sulfide and calcium sulfide. We find these in weird meteorites called enstatite chondrites that have these phases in them. On Earth, all magnesium and calcium is basically bonded with oxygen. On Mercury, it's bonded with sulfur. And so the sulfur contents of magmas on Earth and the Moon, it's a kind of trace, like hundreds, thousands of parts per million in a typical lava. On Mercury, it's weight percent, 5, 6, 7 weight percent. So we see the surface of Mercury is very sulfur rich. But not metal rich. So if you were going to mine things on Mercury, what you'd have to deal with is sulfur, lots of sulfur.
And even like a volcano, like right now, there aren't any active volcanoes on Mercury that we're aware of. But if we saw one erupting, we're familiar with shield volcanoes, with, the various ones that can do pyroclastic flows and things like that. If we were watching a volcanic eruption on Mercury with this different composition what will we see?
We see flood basalts similar to like the Mare basalts on the moon. We see those. They tend to be very old, kind of the billions of years old. On top of that, we also see lots of pyroclastic eruptions. These are volatile rich that make, you know, kind of cinders. You think it was like cinder cone type constructions. And there's some really interesting work that's been going on trying to get the age of those, but they seem to have lasted much longer in the history of Mercury. And so some of them seem to be quite young, kind of less than a billion years old. So if there was going to want to erupt today, it'd probably be a pyroclastic shooting things high up, not into the atmosphere. There's no atmosphere on Mercury. What those gases would be is a huge question. It would not be water or CO2, which is what it is on Earth, because of the low oxygen fugacity. So it'd probably be like hydrogen sulfide, carbon monoxide, things that would be pretty nasty to be around.
And so what are the big unanswered questions about Mercury? I mean, we've had a couple of flybys. There was BepiColombo, there was NASA's Messenger mission. What do we want to know about Mercury? If you're just sort of like, what's the top of the list right now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so many things. I think if I could get, one measurement for Mercury, it would be an isotope measurement. Something like oxygen isotope measurement on Mercury would tell us a huge amount about how Mercury formed and its evolution. But maybe even more importantly, it would tell us a huge amount about how the solar system formed and what the Earth is made of and how the moon formed. One of these kind of interesting holes in our knowledge is, while we have samples of Mars from meteorites, we have samples of moon that we return, we have samples of the outer solar system from meteorites, we even have samples of comets, we don't seem to have a single sample from our solar system sunward of the Earth. None of the meteorites seem to come from there. We haven't had a sample returned from Venus or Mercury. And what that would tell us is, maybe in large scale, how stratified the solar system is compositionally. Our kind of current models, I'd say there's some consensus of that it's highly stratified. And so every different orbit would have a different composition. This creates huge problems for the giant impact hypothesis for the moon, because we would think the impact would be very different from the Earth in composition. And yet, what we see is the moon and the Earth are super similar in their composition. Gotten people to question whether the giant impact happened. There's this huge kind of huge crisis in moon formation where the geochemists say it's very similar to the Earth and the giant impact hypothesis says that doesn't really make sense. But if we went to Mercury and found, oh, actually Mercury is similar to the Earth in composition, maybe that tells us that the inner solar system is homogenized. And we wouldn't expect the impactor to be different. Even the composition of the Earth, we know it's a mixture of some inner solar system material with outer solar system material. We don't really know what that inner solar system material is, and Mercury is probably our best bet for getting that pure ingredient. The Earth is a mixture, and we can kind of guess what it is, but to get the pure ingredient would be extremely important. So that measurement would be fantastic. How Mercury internally differentiated on the moon, we had this idea of a magma ocean. And, when you look at the moon and you see the white material, that's a plagioclase that floated out of this magma ocean. Did that happen on Mercury? We don't see the same kind of white material in North Acidic feldspar. It's very dark. We think maybe graphite floated out of the magma ocean if it had one. Maybe sulfides floated out, but we don't really know. So how its magma ocean evolved and how it internally differentiated would be a huge question.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, with Earth, we've got the core and then we've got the mantle and we've got the crust on top of it. And so it's almost like we've got a Mercury inside of the Earth. And if we can go and then look at the Mercury, that'll give us a better sense of what the interior of Earth might look like.
Yeah, I mean, there's the problem of it being this oxygen-starved planet with very different kind of compositional evolution. But it is, you know, the core is gigantic. The radius of Mercury is like 2,400 kilometers. 2,000 of that about is the core. So when you're standing on the surface of Mercury, you're very close to the core. From like an Earth point of view, like as we sit here on the surface of Earth, the core of the Earth is quite far away from us. We normally think of the couple hundred kilometers above the Earth's core as the core mantle boundary. It's like the boundary region between the core and the mantle. On Mercury, you're kind of standing in the core mantle boundary, the boundary region there. So yeah, there might be some interesting aspects of understanding the core because you're so close to it.
All right, I'm convinced Mercury is interesting, so let's explore it. Now, as I, you know, the ESA's BepiColombo is sort of making its final gravitational assist to try and go into orbit around Mercury. But you recently at the Lunar Planetary Science Conference presented an idea for the Mercury Scout, which would use a solar sail. So give us an idea of what how this mission would work.
Yeah. So the origin of the mission was trying to fill, in NASA speak, a knowledge gap. And that knowledge gap is what is the mineralogy of the surface of Mercury? MESSENGER, the first orbital mission around Mercury, had a spectrometer that on any other planet would have told us a lot about the mineralogy of Mercury. So like Mars, the moon, these kind of visible near infrared spectrometers are great at identifying minerals. And so the idea was that would be great to put on MESSENGER to find out the minerals on Mercury. And unfortunately did not identify any minerals. And the problem was we didn't know about this low oxygen fugacity of Mercury. That was something that came out of the MESSENGER mission, more or less unexpectedly. The problem is that this visible near-infrared spectrometers, the absorptions they're looking at are largely iron oxide, iron oxygen bonds in silicate minerals. There is very little to no iron in silicate minerals on Mercury because of the low oxygen fugacity. So there was nothing for the visible near-infrared spectrometer to work with. There wasn't a problem with the spectrometer. It was just the mineralogy, the composition of the minerals is different than we expected. And a colleague of mine, Jack Mustard, working with people at JPL, had been working on a mid-IR spectrometer that could identify minerals. And I was sitting in PhD committee, and they were showing it. And I noticed that it actually, the absorptions were better with less iron. And they were, oh, send it to the moon. I was like, no, we got to send this to Mercury. This is made for Mercury because the minerals don't have any iron. And so that was the origin of like, let's get this spectrometer to Mercury. And so then he was like, well, how do we get it there? What's the cheapest path? And, you know, can I make it into like a simplex level, which is kind of a small scale mission? How small can we get it? How cheap can we get it? And that led me to solar sails, reading papers and saying, oh, this is a good way to get to Mercury. So I contacted Les Johnson down at Marshall Space Flight Center. And to my, you know, surprise, he answered my email and away we went. And I came up with this idea of trying to fly this spectrometer to Mercury to map the mineralogy. Along the way, we kind of said, well, is there something else you'd want to put on there? And another bit of a knowledge gap right now is the imaging, just the visible imaging from Mercury's surface from MESSENGER and from BepiColombo are the best images are kind of the 10 meter per pixel scale, you know, more typically kind of 20, 30 meter per pixel. And, you know, there's a lot of good science that we can do if we can get down a meter per pixel scale. And that also kind of fed into this idea that's been put in the last couple NASA decadal surveys. This is where they kind of lay out the future plans and the really big missions get laid out. And a Mercury lander has been in the last couple decadal surveys. The last decadal is highly ranked, but not selected. And kind of one aspect of putting a lander on the surface of Mercury, you want the highest resolution images you can get to make sure that things are boulder free. And so part of Mercury Scout, the high resolution images, they have a big science component, but it's also, the Scout name is kind of like we're scouting for a landing site for this eventual much larger lander mission. Kind of that would be at that new, the flagship level, NASA, in NASA speak, flagship level, kind of over $1 billion kind of missions for the lander. Scout, we're trying to get it a lot cheaper than that.
Right. So like into the probe class, discovery class, like a inexpensive or.
Yeah. Inexpensive in NASA terms. Yeah. I was hoping to get it below the discovery, you know, kind of 100, 200 million, but I think it eventually costed out in the kind of 400 million.
Right. But I think that would still be mind blowing that you could have a mission to Mercury that could scan the surface at this level of resolution, take these kinds of images for that kind of a budget. And what I think is the best part, test out a technology that you know, still hasn't been properly tested in a real scientific operation yet, which I think would be great. I mean, there's, you know, NASA has the ACES mission, which is a demonstration of a solar sail. And obviously, you know, Les Johnson was part of the NEA Scout mission that failed. So now, like, let's see a solar sail actually perform and do this job. So why does a solar sail make a lot of sense for a mission to Mercury?
Yeah, I mean, in a kind of gross analogy, you want to sail where the wind's blowing. The closer the solar sails work off light, the stronger the light is, the more push you get on your sail. And so the first place you would want to do a solar sail mission would be towards the sun. I think Mercury is clearly, in my opinion, the best place to do the first planetary mission with a solar sail. And so that was kind of the origin of it. There's this huge problem getting to Mercury. I saw your preview video last week. You did a great job of showing the difficulty of getting Mercury. And it's kind of as hard to get to Mercury as it is to get out to Pluto. You know, the problem is you have to bring fuel to kind of slow down to get to Mercury, but that fuel has mass. So then you have to bring more fuel to slow that fuel down. And there's no fuel with the solar sail. And the closer you get to the sun, the stronger the push. And so it just makes a huge amount of sense if you're going inwards to take advantage of that. Even the Messenger mission, the people who worked on that, when I talk about the solar sail mission, they're like, we did the first solar sailing. So Messenger, they actually, just from the solar panels, they had enough area that they actually got a little bit of boost from solar sailing. So they say they were the first solar sail.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know
just
that.
A little bit.
But yeah. But I mean, you know, it's a non-zero difference and it improves it and it gives you a data point.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's really interesting.
So yeah, and then, you know, the thing that surprised me, I had thought kind of solar sails were, you know, kind of science fiction or, you know, kind of in the distant future, but Les and his team, they have a 1,700 square meter solar sail ready to go. It's built. It's in NASA speak TRL-6, which means it is ready to be put on a mission. It was built for a mission called Solar Cruiser, which got canceled, put on pause. But the sail is there. And kind of part of the original, you know, when I was first starting this, like, man, maybe we can take that sail and put our mission on it. But ended up being our mission was either a little too heavy or the sail was a little too small. But that sail is there. And you know, I think there's fantastic things we can do with solar sails. You know, obviously I love Mercury and I think, you know, going there with the solar sail, but there's a lot of other uses for solar sail.
And I think I need to reiterate just for a second. And also Anton made a really cool animation, so we need to be able to show it, which is, you know, I'm sure a lot of people are thinking about this and like the sun is pushing outward. How can you have a solar sail go closer to the sun? But the thing that really matters is that your solar sail is in orbit around the sun in the way that any spacecraft is going to be in orbit around the sun. And that if you accelerate in one direction, you're going to raise your orbit. You're going to move farther away from the sun. If you decelerate, you're going to move closer to the sun. And so it's really just the angle of the solar sail. You put it 145 degrees and the photons are bouncing off and they're accelerating your spacecraft. You turn it 90 degrees. Now the photons are decelerating the sail and weirdly causing you to get closer and closer and then speed up your orbital speed as you get closer and closer to the sun. And you could theoretically just spiral yourself right into the sun if your spacecraft could withstand the heat. And so I love that analogy that you sail where the wind is blowing, you solar sail where the photons are streaming, and the closer you get to the sun, the better it gets. And it feels like if you guys can prove this, then it feels inevitable that all inner solar system missions will use a solar sail to some capacity because it's just free propellant.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not necessarily either or. You know, one of the things that really struck me, I was lucky enough to go out and see the TRL-6 unfurled sail that Les and the team he worked with.
And sorry, I gotta clarify this for people. Sorry, that TRL is technological readiness level. And so NASA has a series of these readiness levels, and the higher it is, the safer it is. And so a lot of the times with new missions, they will incorporate one or two of these technologies, and they will try to raise their readiness level through that mission or through additional research. And James Webb had a bunch of them, and maybe too many, which is part of the reason why James Webb took so long and cost so much money, was that there was too many technologies that had to be raised up. And so to know that there is a solar sail that has already gone through this process, sitting there waiting for a payload, has got to be really you know, intriguing.
And the final part is they build the thing and then they put it in a vacuum chamber and they heat it up and they shake it and they simulate launch conditions and what out in space. So it's a really thorough testing. So I went out there and I saw and it's super impressive technically, but in some sense, simple, like compared to a rocket engine. When I look at, you know, rocket engines with all the valves and the fancy cones and shapes, like, there's no way I could make that. But a solar sail, you know, it's essentially if you had a couple of tape measures and some Mylar, you know, you can make a very crude solar sail that would work at some level out in space. And so the idea, and it doesn't have any explosive fuel on it, so you could make it and kind of, you know, have it on a shelf somewhere. Yeah, it's kind of fascinating that way. And presumably it would be cheap once we learn to make them. It's really, you know, a couple of carbon fiber booms and some very fancy sheets of plastic, but it's not, you know, niobium rocket cones and this kind of stuff. So the idea that, okay, maybe your mission's main propulsion could be chemical, but there'd be a sail component to it where it made sense. I think a lot of missions could use a solar sail. Part of, you know, what we did with Mercury Scout, we were trying to see how small we can get it. And we got it down to about 300 kilograms. We really have like two instruments. We have this spectrometer and this camera, and that's pretty lean for a planetary mission. So I feel like we kind of are exploring this, like, kind of what's the smallest, in science we talk smallest publishable unit for papers, like what's the smallest viable planetary mission that would make sense, and I think we're pretty close to that, and we maybe could get it a little lower in mass, but if we could make it work and get the right sail size for this kind of 200-300 kilogram mission, I think it would open up a lot of missions in the inner solar system, including out to the moon and to Mars.
And so could you just off the shelf, like the calculations that you made, that was using the solar cruiser sail in its current version?
So we started, you know, like, hey, can we do solar cruiser a little bit bigger? So if I recall, we started with a 2,500 square meter sail with the idea that would still fit in to the this TRL-6, like that NASA would still think it was viable at its current testing level. That's when we is like, oh yeah, that I think it was going to take us like 20 years to get there. It's just not enough oomph. Even with the 2,500 square meter sail, the force on this sail from light, I believe Les talks about it as like the weight of a quarter on your hand. It's not a lot. The benefit, though, is you're stacking quarters every second of every day, and it never switches off. Whereas a big rocket, yeah, it puts out huge amounts of thrust for 20 minutes, 30 minutes, a few hours, and then it stops. But the solar sail, you just keep stacking up those quarters, and eventually, you can get going pretty fast. But yeah, the solar cruiser 2,500 square meter sail just wasn't quite enough oomph for 300 kilos. So we bumped it up to 5,000 square meters, which hasn't been made yet and probably is lower TRL level, some technology to get it there. With that, we got it on par with Messenger and BepiE kind of 7-year transit times, which is totally viable. I think to really get the benefits of a solar sail for this size mission, for a 300 kilogram kind of mission, if we get to 10,000 square meters, then I think we're rocking and rolling. Then it's clear that this solar sail is better. You can get to Mercury in 4 years. And just go straight there. That's not even with any assist from any planet flybys. You just go straight there.
Right. And once you're there, you still have full thrust. So then you can change your orbit. You can do all kinds of crazy things.
Yeah. So, Messenger was a fantastic mission, but it ran out of fuel. So it orbited from 2011 to 2015. BepiE is going to orbit for 2, maybe 3 years, but you run out of gas and you're like, oh, I want to keep going. So yeah, being able to run longer duration missions would be huge scientifically. For example, the camera, this high resolution camera we want to put on the mission, the trade-off is the amount of area it looks at with any image is tiny. The resolution's high, but you're looking at a small spot. And so you're not getting global coverage. You're kind of taking little postage stamps. But the longer you can fly, the more area you can cover with that high resolution imaging.
Give us a sense. People are fairly familiar with the images coming back from, say, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter or the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. I mean, you're looking at features that are tens of centimeters to less than a meter across kind of resolution. What would you be looking to achieve with the Scout?
Oh, yeah. I mean, no, the list is long. Craters, right? The more craters you can see down to smaller sizes, you can.
What resolution? Same kind of resolution, tens of centimeters to.
Yeah. A meter? So, half a meter, quarter meter, resolution. One of the things with the orbits that we were using, and one of the things you have to deal with Mercury, and it's kind of the flip side to having more light to push your sail around, is things are hot. And not just the sun beating on the spacecraft, but Mercury is hot, and you get a lot of reflected heat from the surface of the planet. So if you look at the orbit of the Messenger mission, it was extremely elliptical. So, here's a big ellipse, like Mercury was like right here. And it spent most of its time far away from Mercury cooling off and then would zip by the North Pole. And so at near the North Pole, that's where you got this kind of 10 meter per pixel imaging with Mercury. But a lot of the surface, as you got far away, the imaging got worse and worse as the distances got longer. Because it only had so much fuel, it could only have the periapsis, the closest approach of the orbit near the North Pole. With the solar sail, we can do that same orbit and get all the imaging we want, but we have infinite fuel, so we can flip it and then have the periapsis in the South Pole. go for 4 or 5 years, or then we can try and flip it and put the periapsis close to the equator. And so then you can get high resolution imaging over the whole surface.
And also, I think, you know, with missions that go to the moon, for example, because its gravity shape is very knobbly and bumpy, it's hard on spacecraft that want to orbit very close to the moon. They crash.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can imagine, but the upside is there's no atmosphere. And so you can make very low flybys, you know, wherever your periapsis is. So couldn't you kind of get brave and do periapsis to take you 100 kilometers above the surface of Mercury, and then you can compensate as you fly back out so you're not in the danger zone? You can fix having to go through that really complicated, you know, gravity well.
Yeah, I think this is a bit of the learning to sail. You know, it's like a little backwards, right? That we learn to sail on our oceans, and then we got motors. In space, we have motors, and eventually we're going to learn how to sail. I asked Les, like, how close can we go? And the problem is Mercury's magnetic field. In that once you start getting close, that will interact with the spacecraft. And, you know, because of this, this idea that there's not even a Mercury at any one moment, the amount of thrust that the sail is giving you is small. You can't make a lot of quick course adjustments. You can over time. And so if you got close to Mercury's surface and something happened with the magnetic field and you needed to make a quick adjustment to not crash, we're not quite sure how that would all work. So the answer is maybe, but I think that's the
But what did he say? What is safe?
You know, there's no line in the sand. There's safer and less safe. Our periapsis is 200 kilometers, and that seemed totally fine. 100 kilometers, we were more running into thermal issues of, you know, you just don't want the spacecraft to heat up too much. You don't want the sail to heat up too much. But, you know, 100 kilometers should be possible, but
right.
We don't know.
But 100 kilometers is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And what I sort of really like is you could be mapping out the surface of Mercury at a certain resolution, and then geologists like you are going to go through this and go, I want better pictures of this exact
right.
spot.
Right.
And then again, you've got all the fuel you could ever want. And so the spacecraft could tack to the exact right orbit for an insertion and take you directly over that specific feature that you're hoping to understand better. Take at the highest resolutions that you're feeling comfortable with. You'll learn that process. You'll come back around. You'll get better and better. You really dial in what effect the heating and the magnetic field has. And then you could theoretically go for decades targeting individual spots on the surface of Mercury and coming back at them in whatever resolution you feel comfortable grabbing. Like, it just feels limitless in a way that, like, when I talk to people who are behind these kinds of missions, they're always so constrained on what they can do. And this, it feels like you could sit down and go, look, what do we want to do now? We got limitless.
I mean, we even talked about, like, once you've done all the measurements you want to do of Mercury, I mean, not that that would ever happen, but at some point you might say, well, why don't, you know, it's a good set of instruments. Why don't we go look at something else in the solar system? You can even, you know, imagine a different way of thinking about missions where we're not just making one mission, it's going to go one place. We're going to make an instrument. We're going to make a mission that has an interesting suite of instruments, and we're going to fly it around the solar system measuring things.
Let's see if we can find some Mercury Trojans or Venus Trojans.
So the craziest aspect of this is maybe not as well known. Like, I imagine you've talked a lot about the polar ices on the moon, and you know, Artemis, let's go get the water, ices at the permanently shattered regions at the poles of the moon. There is far more ice on Mercury than there is on the moon in the permanently shadowed craters. There's actual visible deposits of ice in the permanently shadowed craters, but they're permanently shadowed. They're hard to take pictures of. So Mercury took pictures of them, but the camera wasn't optimized for it. So you can stretch the images, you can kind of see it. I think Bepi will get kind of similar images. And so I was like, well, can we image to see them? And you could mess with the camera to do that, but then it would be hard to use it on other parts of it. It's like, well, we need a light source. You know, how can we get some light down into those craters? You bring a big flashlight.
Man, I see where this is going. Well,
what if you had a 5,000 square meter mirror?
Reflector.
To bound. This is Les Johnson had this idea. They were going to do it for the lunar ISIS. So, you know, one experiment we would love to do would be to see if we could get the sail in just the right angle to bounce. It doesn't have to be a ton of light down into a crater to get a better image of it. So that would be a really fun. Mm. You wouldn't have to say, oh, but we're going to burn all this fuel doing it. You got, as you said, unlimited fuel.
That's amazing. I want to shift gears then and sort of move into the hypothetical, but I know it's an idea that you've been thinking quite a lot about, and that is lander sample return and how a mission like this might be able to play a role in that, because that seems like an obvious fit. So give me a sense of sort of, you know, in the recent decadal survey, people asked for a Mercury lander. Give me a sense of what that mission was hoped to be.
Yeah. So, and we are full guns going to put in another lander for the next decadal.
2030.
Yeah. With these missions, you have to have long time views. So yeah, the lander, there's a lot of different things you would love to do with the lander. A seismometer on the surface would be huge. We don't know if Mercury has a solid inner core. It definitely has some part of a liquid core because it has a magnetic field. But how big an inner core is, we don't know. That would tell us a lot about its evolution. We don't really know. The thickness of the crust is a variable. The density of the crust, these things would tell us a huge amount about the internal evolution and history of Mercury. There's an aspect of solar system evolution and that we don't really have a sample of the solar system sunward of the Earth. And that's a huge hole in our knowledge and understanding about how chemically stratified the solar system is. Even things like what the Earth is made of, we know it's made of outer solar system material and some inner solar system material, but we don't really have a pure sample of that inner solar system material. So getting a chemical analysis, particularly an isotope analysis of Mercury's surface would be huge for understanding the evolution of the solar system. I mean, I've had conversations where geochemists have said, point blank, we are not going to understand the evolution of the solar system until we get a compositional measurement of Mercury. So that would be huge.
And so you, in this case, you're talking about just doing this in situ, like
That would be in situ. That gets us, so we don't really have that technology yet. We can measure isotope ratios, but what we'd really want is something like oxygen at a certain accuracy. And so that's a technology development project. The ultimate would be a sample return that we could then use all the instruments we have here on Earth to really investigate it. Here again, you run into the issue of, you know, you can, this whole, you know, bringing fuel to Mercury to stop yourself. Well, now you have to bring a lander and the rocket that's going to come back, and that's going to have a huge amount of fuel. If you do it all with chemical rockets, the size of the mission just explodes. But a solar sail, you use it to get there. You know, maybe it's assisted with chemical rockets. And then once you get the sample off the surface of Mercury, you hook it up to the sail and let the sun blow you back to the Earth. And so while the solar sail planetary mission like Mercury Scout, I think there's a lot of advantages to it. For sample return, it's cut and dry. Even with the sails we have now, it would be way better to do a sample return with a solar sail than a chemical rocket.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about an example, say China's, was it Chang'e 4, where they did a sample return from the moon. And so you've got this lander.
Yeah. Chang'e 5 and 6, yeah.
Chang'e 5 and 6. Okay, yeah. Yeah, so they land, they scoop up a little bit of material, they pack it into a rocket, and they fire it off, and then it falls back into Earth's gravity well, re-enters the Earth's atmosphere. So it would be something kind of like that.
But yes, it would be much closer. Yeah, it would be very much like Chang'e 5 and 6, more so than Mars sample return. Mars sample return is a much more sophisticated rover getting tubes from different places. And this would be kind of a land and grab and send it back. So much, much simpler. A lot of the commercial companies that are part of the CLIPS missions going to the moon have models of sample return architectures that they're going to be building. So hopefully, you know, in the next 10 years or so, we're going to have four or five different options that are aimed at the moon. And one hope is maybe we can say, hey, you know, can you send one to Mercury for us?
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, you haven't brought it up, but I'm going to bring it up, and that's a rover. Mm. You know, does a rover make, of course it makes sense. Okay. So how does a rover make sense on Mercury?
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating to see the lander missions on the moon, where it's like, you know, one mission has like two or three rovers and a hopper. And, you know, there was one that had a rover that there was a rover on top of the rover to kind of clean off the solar panels and check it out. So, yeah, I feel like all the innovation that's happening on the moon, for every reason it's happening on the moon, you can just translate that to Mercury. So, yes, you have a lander. If it just lands in one spot, it's kind of you take what you get. But if you have a rover that can look around and do in situ analyses, that would be fantastic. If it could bring us samples back, even if you're doing in situ analyses, from the main lander, if you can have rovers go out and bring samples back to the main lander, that would be huge. And yeah, if you wanted to get down inside of craters, there's some very unique features on Mercury called hollows. We haven't talked about these, but we're not totally sure what they are, but they're in many craters, on the moon and on Mercury, they get filled with lava, probably from impact melt sheets. So you get a big impact, melts a lot of rock. And so you see these craters that should be bowl-shaped, they have flat floors. You see this all over, that's nothing. What you see on Mercury is tens to 100 meters of this material apparently evaporating into space, just disappearing. And it's like, oh, these like volcanoes or something. Well, no, there's no rim of material. It's just like flat and then a pit and flat. And then if you have two pits near each other, they go down to the same depth. And you're like, what is that? And the closest we see is like the poles of Mars. When they're sublimating, they have similar structures. So we think there's like tens of meters of rock of that. Like, what is that about? So our best guess is that it's sulfide. It's tens to 100 meters of sulfide that's evaporating out into space. It would be fantastic to have a hopper hop down in to one of these hollows to check it out. So yeah, anything and everything would be fantastic.
Yeah. And you do suffer the same problem with the moon, that you're going to be in shadow for a long time.
Yeah. So then we get into Mercury's wacky orbit, right? So the moon is tidally locked to the Earth, so we always see one face of the moon, right? So one orbit is one rotation. Mercury is in this kind of weird 2-3 resonance where the day is longer than the year. So it rotates two times every three revolutions around Mercury. And so, you know, the 1 year is like 88 Earth days long, but 1 day on Mercury is twice that. It's 176 days long. And so then a result of that is if you were kind of watching a day go by on Mercury, what you would see is the sun, if you were saying at certain parts along the equator, you'd see the sun come up and then it would go retrograde for a little, it would go backwards and then it would go forwards again. And that happens on two parts of the equator, and those get heated more. And so there's two parts along the equator that are called hot poles that get heated more than the two points kind of 100 or 90 degrees from there. And yeah, you're close to the sun, so it's very hot. Yeah, surviving the night, surviving the day, like what, like on the moon, it's surviving the night. On Mercury, it might be more like surviving the night, or that the day might be harder than surviving the night. So not clear exactly how, you know, what's the better bet to,
but if you've got a fast enough rover or a hopper or something, maybe you could just stay in the perfect temperature. Like you could, you know, I was sort of have this science fiction thought that you could, you know, if you were marooned on Mercury, as long as you kept walking, you could stay at whatever temperature regime you want to be, that you can outwalk the sunrise or outwalk the sunset. And so I can imagine some rover that its only job is to keep moving.
Yes. Yeah. Don't get bogged down. Yeah. You know, I think it, those kind of creative thoughts, you know, a similar one is maybe you hide in the permanently shadowed craters, right? So, you know, if you get too cold, you kind of come and stick something out into the sunlight to warm up a bit. And then you can go explore for a while. If you get too hot, you can go back into the permanently shadowed crater to cool down a little bit.
Oh, that's cool. It like has some kind of, I don't know, mast that it puts up to keep itself warm.
Yeah.
And the rest of the time it's down in the crater. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
My last question that I always ask people, Stephen, what are you obsessed with right now?
What am I obsessed with? I have to say, I mean, obviously a simple one would be Mercury and getting an isotope measurement for Mercury and solar sails. I would throw out the Perseverance rover has gotten outside of Jezero crater and is seeing all sorts of really interesting things that we haven't really seen. It basically looks like it's roving over the impact ejecta from Jezero. There was this amazing sample that was just all impact melt spherules, which is just amazing. So yeah, I follow that every day. You can see the images that come down. And if I have time, I watch that and try and see what they've found. So yeah, love
I mean,
what Perseverance
there are thousands is coming out of that camera system, you know, of all the different cameras on that every day, every week.
Yeah, I mean, they're up to, I mean, Perseverance is like hundreds of thousands of images. It's amazing that they put it up every day. You have the map, you can see where it's going. It is just, yeah, I feel like I'm living in a science fiction movie right. From where I grew up when there weren't that many missions, and certainly you weren't getting it on a daily basis. I can wake up in the morning, like, oh, let's see what Curiosity rover is seeing today.
So I think people are familiar with that rock. I reported on it, that it looks like someone took a whole bunch of BBs, like little metal balls made of rock, and just squish them all together, like styrofoam, like fairly large grain styrofoam, all crushed together into a rock.
Yep.
And sort of one thought here is that these are spherules that are produced by some kind of accretion method, that it's being turned into a, that was then mushed into a block. You're thinking, no, that looks a lot more like ejecta that's, you know, created little frozen balls of rock.
Yeah, it's not just my thing. You know, talking to kind of colleagues and stuff. Part of the work I've done on the moon is looking at melt spherules. We see these on the moon. Some of them are made by volcanoes. It's kind of what happens when a melt gets into a vacuum. It tends to blow itself apart into these little BBs. But a lot of them on the moon are from impact. So the impact hits, melts a lot of rock, it makes these little BBs. And so if you just scoop up some soil from the moon, 5, 10, 20% of that are these impact spherules. The Chang'e 5 mission that we mentioned, there's some great work that came out of that, looking at thousands of these melt spherules. We see them on Earth. If you go to Haiti or there's an island off the coast of South America, you can find the melt spherules from the Chicxulub impact that killed the dinosaurs. So this is kind of a known thing. And when you look at that rock and all the other images that Perseverance is seeing, because you don't just see, you know, you see the spheres, they're shiny, kind of glassy. A lot of them, if you look, have a little hole in them, like a bubble popped. And that's a melt thing that you're devolatilizing it. So that's kind of indicative. And then the other one that's pretty diagnostic is sometimes what happens with these melt beads is they collide or they're spinning so fast, they almost split, but they don't. And you get these like little dumbbells or these like stretched shapes. And you can see those in the image as well. So between the bubbles and these elongated things and the glassy nature, nothing's for sure, but I would bet a nickel that that's an impact.
But do you need some other process that agglomerates them together afterwards? Like water?
I think the rocks, if you look at the rocks they're looking at right now, you can see they're layered and you can see to me what looks like layers of the melt spherules that are getting kind of smeared out. Jezero is a huge crater and the energies are huge. And so it's not just like little glass beads, raining gently down. It's like you're near a giant nuclear bomb and all sorts of hell's breaking loose. There's ash, there's chunks of rock, there are these beads. Sometimes they're getting smushed into a solid layer and you lose the beads and they're just smashed back. Sometimes it's partial. And if you look at those images, you can see all of that. In my mind, going on there. And I think this is kind of why I'm obsessed with it, because, you get the images, you don't get they're not telling you what they're thinking, right? Because they're going to publish that in papers. So there's this little like follow along and try and guess what they're looking at right now.
Right. Yeah. Like looking over the shoulder of somebody who is looking at some target with a telescope.
Right.
And you're like, huh. That's an interesting target you got there in the telescope.
Yes.
What is that? Well, yes. I'm not telling.
Yes.
Right. And you're gonna have to figure that out.
Yeah. So I love the puzzle.
Is that Planet Nine? Is that what we're seeing right now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. And you can see like they see a rock and it's like, oh, I would go check that. Like, are they going to go look at that? Oh no, they drove by it. So there's an aspect of like, where are they going to go next? Right. Is also
backseat Mars driving.
Right.
I love it.
Guess the next yeah. Move.
Right. And I wonder, though, if because they make everything so public, people are able to go, wait, that's really important. Stop. Go back and check that out.
Oh, yeah. So, I don't know how much you follow the Perseverance rover, but they went by some super interesting rocks. I mean, from some point of view, you'd say that is the one rock you should go analyze, but it was in a place where they couldn't get to. Mm. And so it's like, oh, that's right there. It's like 10 meters away. Go. No, can't. Can't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Well, Stephen, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I'm looking forward to a mission to Mercury with solar sail. That all sounds great. So good luck in making this happen.
Yep. Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Dr. Stephen Parman. Now, I continued the conversation with him in a new direction, talking about how Mercury is very useful as a way to think about exoplanets and how, some of the first planets that we're going to see will be Mercury's. And what can that tell us both about exoplanets in general, as well as our better understanding of how this Earth and the rest of the solar system formed? We have that as a longer interview plus video over on Patreon. So you can watch that completely for free. There's no ads. You don't have to sign up. And you can watch this full interview plus the extra part over on Patreon. I'll put a link in the show notes. I'm going to give you some final thoughts, but first I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Androm Gross, Barely Griffing, Brian Body, Caredwin, Chuck Hawkins, Commander Baylock, Cy Nelson, David Gilton, and David Matz, Dustin Cable, Evan Pro, Greg Feely, Hans Schultz, Hudson Ward, Jay Graves, James Clark, Jeremy Madden, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Marcel Smits, Michael Purcell, Modso, Paul Robach, Ren Kaidu, Robeck, Sean Sargent, Stanislaw Zarajev, Stephen Fowler Munley, Thomas L. Skadron, Vlad Shiplin, and Wolfgang Klotz, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all our patrons. All your support means universe to us. So you probably know that I am quite excited about the idea of solar sails. I love this concept of having a propellantless method of exploring the solar system, and that technology works best as you get closer and closer to the sun. And so this just feels like an absolutely natural idea And that we could see this is the first of many missions where we start to see how far we can push this idea of using solar sails. We could use solar sails to get really rapid flybys next to the sun and then move out further into the solar system. This could be the fastest way to reach the solar gravitational lens. So I've got a couple of other interviews that I've done that I think you would find really interesting. One is an interview with Les Johnson about solar sails and sort of that underlying technology. You should check that out. And then the other one is with Slava Turishev, who is the mind behind the solar gravitational lens. I've done two interviews with him, one about the gravitational lens itself, but then the second interview is about using a solar sail, doing a close flyby of the sun, and using that as a way to get out to the solar gravitational lens in the shortest amount of time possible. And I think you'll find that conversation very interesting. I'll put links to all those interviews in the show notes. All right, I hope you enjoyed this interview. We'll see you next time.